views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Executives After Hours, episode number 89. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. To those of you tuning in for the very first time, I say a thank you. This is a podcast about all things authentic. So what does that mean for you? Well, I seek out individuals across a variety of different industries, and I interview them about their journey, both their personal and they're professional. I believe that every individual has a story to be told, and I want to help them tell their story. And today is no different. Today I had the honor and privilege to interview the regional director of North America and Africa for the Havas People Group, Mr. Paul Turner. The Havas People is part of the Havas Group, a global advertising agency with offices all around the world. And Paul has recently, in the last 2 years, taken up shop here in Dubai to grow their Havas People Group. Havas People Group specializes in working with clients or consulting with clients around the concept of engagement in the workforce, recruiting the right people, keeping the right people, and inspiring the right people. Paul and I talk about a number of different topics, from growing up in England to a dad that was a banker to being inspired by some of his teachers. We also dive into what exactly he does, so stay tuned for that. Today's episode is brought to you by Engage Me. Engage Me is an online magazine focused on employee engagement with all sorts of relevant, interesting, fun articles. Go to engageme.online. Also brought to you today by Transformation Radio. I'm now part of the Conscious Business Network that goes around to 1,000 bazillion different stations. So stay tuned today. I have the regional director for the Havas People, Mr. Paul Turner. And as always, please leave a review on iTunes. If you have any questions, please email me. And to that ado, have a wonderful, fantastic, splendid week. One thing I want to mention though, do this while you're running, while you're walking, while you're going to the gym, but be active, people. It makes you feel better. It makes you feel human. So don't sit down and listen to this. Get up and move to this. Have a great week. Executive After Hours, I have the honor and privilege to interview Paul Turner. I'm so nervous I'm going to say your name wrong. So I'm like looking around like it's a Turner. I am infamous for just completely shitting people's names up all the time. And I will say I'm thankful because you're the first person in about 7 interviews that has a pronounceable first and last name. So thank you for that.
It's a pleasure.
Paul is the regional director of Middle East and South Africa for Havas Group, or Havas People specifically, a sub department, I guess. I don't know. You can explain that better than I can, probably. Paul and I have been talking for a while, and I thought, you know, as I try to expand my footprint here in the Middle East, Paul tries to expand his footprint in the Middle East. And he's got a plethora of experience. It could be a really fun conversation. So, Paul, thanks for stopping by.
It's a pleasure. Really enthused about this. I was rather nervous to start with, but I think we'll be okay. Hopefully I'll say something interesting along the way.
Well, if you're British, you're going to use self-deprecating humor throughout the whole process. So don't worry about it.
That's what we do. That's what we do. And irony. I'll be using heavy use of irony all the way through as well.
Well, I'll try to make sure I don't get lost in the heavy doses of irony to go with this. So Paul, just to kind of back up or give me a 10,000 foot, quickly tell me about your role in Havas Group.
So Havas Group is one of the world's largest PR marketing and advertising agencies. So in the same sort of field as people like WPP, Publicis, etc. But Havas People, which is the part I work for, is essentially the part of the business which allows big corporate organizations generally to talk to their existing employees and also helps them with strategies to attract new employees into the organization. So we're very much about people comms, and particularly with a branding and marketing sphere of focus that we bring to that sort of activity. We are well established. We started in the UK in the 1940s, I understand. I wasn't quite around then.
way to reference your age subtly. Yeah. I like it.
And we spread globally. So we have five offices in the UK. We're in New York. We're in Australia. We're in mainland Europe, and we opened a Dubai office back in May 2015. I'm trying to build a business, and I think over the last 2 years, I've been pretty successful. We're using resources in London to service the business, but we're working with clients such as Dubai Airports, Jumeirah Group, Emirates, Cleveland Clinic, Shalhoub Group. So we're making great inroads into that sort of whole employer brand space, employee comms, employee engagement type activity.
And that's awesome. So, you know, one of the things I'm always interested in is how does someone decide at, you know, the ripe age of 25 to go to Dubai? But, you know, because somewhere along your life, you had to have some adventure seeking desires and a drive to do something different. What's interesting about, you know, Paul's career, your career, is that you've essentially been in the same industry for a very long time. And so there seems to be this contradictiveness in terms of, I want to seek adventure, but I like to have the same thing. So as you were growing up, I mean, did you grow up in a big family, a small family?
Yeah, so my family was pretty standard, I think. There were four kids. I was the eldest of four, so I've got a brother and two sisters. My dad worked in a bank for 30 years, 35 years. I was the first person in our family to go to university. I think that was quite a biggie at the time.
Was that stressed by your parents?
My parents put no stress on me whatsoever, absolutely none whatsoever. I think more of that came from teachers at school who felt that I had the sort of the capacity, the brains, the personality, if you like, to try university. And at that time in the UK, university was a relatively elite experience. I think in recent years it's much more universal, but at that time, it wasn't the norm to go to university, and I went to Durham University in the northeast of England, which is probably one of the best universities. I have to say, I didn't go particularly on the strength of my A-level grades. I went more on my sporting ability. I had a very good friend who was a very good cricketer, and he'd gone to Durham the year before, and Durham was a very strong sporting university, and I got in on on my rather limited cricketing ability, but I have to say that it's one of the best experiences of my life, and I still have friends that I made nearly 40 years ago from that time at university. And those, you know, we keep in touch. We go on weekends away when we get together. We have a sort of yearly reunion. So it's just amazing to see how people have come and the journeys they've gone through too.
And I imagine when you guys get out there, you go to the cricket pitch and pretend like you're 18 to 22 again and try to bowl a ball and get a wicket. That's the extent of my cricket knowledge, but I think that sounded pretty good, by the way.
Yeah, it's probably about the same as my American football knowledge, although I hear it's a good game tonight. I think what happens when we do get together, it's funny because obviously the group's extended as various people have got married and had kids and stuff. We just sit around and we tell the same old stories. And people weren't there, our respective wives, husbands, must sit there and thinking, what the heck is going on here? Yeah. These guys, they've known each other, they tell the same stories every single year. They don't seem to get bored of it. But I think that common frame of reference is a really important part of your upbringing and your grounding. And I think that the friends I made at school and at university are still some of my closest friends. And I think that's a really important philosophy. I think to keep in touch with your roots and where you came from is really important.
So I also played sports in college, and I also was mediocre. So we have that in common as well. but thinking about you going to university, now when you made this decision to go, was there a teacher who was highly influential to you that kind of said, listen, Paul, you know, your parents didn't go, you have a chance to do something different, obviously not in those terms, but was there someone who was influential during your high school academics that kind of pushed you in a way?
Yeah, absolutely. There was one particular teacher who...
Isn't there always one? There's like one.
Yeah, it is. And it was, you know, looking back on it now, I don't think I realised just quite how influential he was. I mean, coming back to cricket, he was Latin. He taught Latin, but he was also in charge of the cricket team. And he put me into that cricket team at I was 16 and most of the rest of the players were 18, which at that age is a massive difference. So he showed faith in me from a sporting point of view, but also from an academic and a mentoring point of view. He was very influential.
Did that give you confidence then? I mean, just that trust and nudge that gave you confidence that you could do it?
Yeah, and I think the thing about it was every school report I ever had was Paul is very diligent, does the work. He's very quiet. He's very shy. And I was a very, very shy, very introverted teenager, I would say. And I think going to university, I made a huge decision. I remember consciously saying to myself, okay, first day at university, I'm going to change my outlook and my personality. And I went out of my way to introduce myself to people, to become more extrovert. And I remember thinking at that age, this is what I need to do in order to make friends, be a success, make an impact.
How uncomfortable was that?
It was really uncomfortable to start with, really uncomfortable.
But were you afraid of? Were you afraid of being rejected? Were you afraid of, you know, the quote unquote real Paul being seen?
I wasn't afraid. I was really excited about it. I made my university choices based on how far away they were from home. So I chose deliberately universities at the far end of the country. So I didn't want to be one of those kids who kept going home at weekends while they're at university. I didn't want my parents and coming to visit me every 2 minutes. And that sounds awful, but I just wanted a new start, if you like. And I think going to Durham, you may or may not know, is a collegiate university. So it's split into smaller colleges. Mm-hmm. And each college has its own personality, its own way of doing things, its own culture, if you like. And I really bought into the culture. And as I say, I made that massive decision. It was a massive decision for me at the time to almost reinvent myself in a different place as a different type of person. And you know, I think throughout life, I can revert back to that rather introverted, shy person.
But then, you think as a human being, though, like, I think we're all introvert to some degree and all extrovert to some degree. And it's just depending where you fall on that sliding scale. And so for someone who's naturally introverted, you know, but you have to be in an extroverted role, you probably crave that quiet time.
Yeah, I think I do to a certain extent, but I think it is possible to change your personality. I think it's possible to adapt your personality to your situation. I think everybody has to do that, particularly as you get more senior in a role, or you get more influential in a role, or as you progress through your.
You don't have to. The people that choose.
It helps,
to,
though. It helps.
Yeah, people that choose to. Those are the people who end up being more successful.
I would say so.
So I was thinking about this, though, like, you know, you obviously had this sense of I need to be more extroverted. Besides school, I mean, was your mom or dad super introverted, or one super extroverted where you thought, look what that does for them?
I think my mom and dad are they're very conservative by nature. And they, you know, my dad has lived. He's a banker. But, you know, so I'll say two things about my dad. He has lived in the same part of the world his whole life. He's now living about 3 miles from where he was born. At one point, we moved house literally 100 yards up the road. So he's always been very, very local. And my mum's the same. I mean, she came from a slightly different part of the country, but she and my dad have lived in the same place throughout their lives. But having said that, my dad, after 30, 35 years in the bank, left the bank and set up a business with a customer of his. They set up a small tire and exhaust business, you know, fitting tires and mufflers, exhaust, whatever you Americans call them these days. And, you know, for him, I guess that was a massive, massive departure, which he did at a relatively late... I don't remember...
Like your bloody man?
I don't remember them having any sort of discussion or conversation about it. It was just a thing that happened. And my dad said, okay, I'm going to do this. And he went off and did it and made a very success of a small business. But it was so far away from the security of a bank where you went to work same hours every single day, you did the same thing every single day. But, you know, it brought him out of himself, I thought, at that time.
So was he always kind of an introvert?
Yeah, I think he is relatively introverted. He's quite shy. He's quite laid back, I would say.
Yeah, you come across as very laid back, though. So I could see you being similar to your dad in that capacity then, yeah? Like a bit introverted, a bit laid back.
I've been described as laid back to the point of ridiculousness.
In fact, when you and I were talking, you were so laid back, you kept laying on the ground. And I was like, come on, Paul, please sit up.
It's my preferred position, you know. Horizontal is good. I was fine.
Do you get along with all your siblings?
So we have at one point or another, with four of us, one or two of us will be either not talking or having a bit of a dispute with the others.
Sounds like my family.
Yeah, but you know how it works. I mean, and particularly my youngest sister is 10 years younger than me. So I think my mum and dad got a bit broody because they had three of us very quickly. I think my mum had three kids before she was 25. And then Caroline came along a bit later. So she was always the spoilt one. So I probably have more arguments with her, and it's probably my fault because I spoiled her when she was a kid. So, but we all get along pretty well. We're all doing quite different things. So, you know, my sister's a teacher. My youngest sister deals in antique clothing. My brother is a furniture maker. So they're all sort of doing different things in their own different sort of different ways.
So this so is that's, go ahead, sorry.
It's a nice mix, I think, and we get on well most.
Well, I was just going to say, like, it's just such an eclectic set of careers that, yeah. What's also interesting is, did your mom work?
She did. She. So in the UK, and your UK listeners will understand this, she was a doctor's receptionist. So it's a GP practice. She would be the receptionist, and
sure.
In the UK, they're notoriously reticent to let you actually see the doctor. So you phone up and say, I want an appointment, and the receptionist will say, well, what's wrong with you? And so you almost have to justify yourself to the receptionist before you get an appointment. So I can just imagine my mum giving people a third degree as to say, you know, are you sure you're ill? Do you really need an appointment?
That's hilarious. So after you graduate, right, so – you know, you spend a big chunk of your career in new business development.
Yes. And
for someone who outright says he was an introvert, and maybe that was a self-perception that you had, and maybe you were actually more extroverted than you realized. Did you consciously choose to go down that route to be an account executive, or did you just kind of fall into that position?
Absolutely fell into it. I left university in the midst of a massive recession in the UK. So my first job was for a roofing firm, working as a roofer. And on the first day, the guy said to me, are you afraid of heights? And I said, I don't know. And So I was sent up a ladder about 10 stories up the side of this office building, sitting on some scaffolding with a pneumatic drill scraping off the old cladding from the side of this building. And I realized I wasn't frightened of heights, so that was good. But in terms
I would have been shitting my pants probably.
Well, it was quite an experience. I think what really I mentioned that for a reason, because I think when you do a manual job like that, which I loved actually, you're outdoors, you were doing stuff, you got your hands dirty, you didn't take it home at the end of the day, you went out and had a drink, and you spent your pay packets and all that sort of stuff. I think that when you go into a sort of more corporate office type environment, you understand the world a little bit better because you understand how people live. So I also worked for my dad's tire and exhaust company, so I would fit tires, I would do truck repairs, I would do all that sort of stuff. And again, you're out and about meeting and interacting with people. And I think too often in a corporate environment, you get a little bit insulated from real people, and you're out of touch with what actually happens to people during their lives. So I think that was a really good grounding for me. And in terms of how I fell into my role, I basically answered an ad in the paper. It was a graduate training scheme. I went along for an interview. I'm not sure how well it went, but the question the guy asked me at the end of it, he said, Paul, what is it about, what is it you actually hate? Well, tell me something you really hate. It was a strange interview question, I think, looking back. And I said, well, I really hate losing. And at the time, I was a very keen sportsman. I hated losing at sport generally. I sort of matured a little bit. I'm less emotional about it these days. But that the answer to that question got me that job. So the guy saw something which he thought, okay, I can use that. I can work with that.
So what's funny about that is, you know, as you and I talked, my first job was a regional manager for a company called Nationwide Advertising. And I had to take one of those personality tests to get the job.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And the test, you know, is basically one of those tests where they ask you the same question slightly differently about 5 or 6 times.
Yes.
So the results come back and I'm 24 and I was applying for a job to open the 41st office for this company, this Nationwide Advertising. And the regional, what was he? The vice president of the Northeast or whatever it was, Northwest, I mean. He said, okay, well, here's your results. Shows you're really competitive and that you lie sometimes. I was like, what? He's like, well, there were some answers that were inconsistent. And so, but he goes, That's all right. I like that you're competitive. And this guy played sports in college. And so he's like, you play sports in college. I like that you're competitive. I can ignore the lying part. Don't worry about it. Mostly you're truthful. And in hindsight, I was thinking, and I'm not a liar. Like, that's not my personality. If you knew anything about me, I'm actually overly honest. But I thought that was hilarious that he was okay with the slight lies in terms of changing the answers because I was competitive, you know?
Yes, yeah.
And so it sounds like, you know, just to kind of move forward a little bit here, it sounds like throughout your career, this sense of being competitive has really paid dividends for you. How has being competitive impacted the choices you've made in the work environment?
Well, I think that's a good point. So I started off as an account handler. I went through a sort of graduate training scheme and primarily was doing client service work. So I was talking to clients day in, day out about what their requirements were, translating those requirements into briefs, into studio, into creative, whatever it might be, and then delivering back those solutions to clients. And after a while, I guess, what happened was I started to work very much with the company I was with. I had a sales and marketing director, and I started working very closely with him on the new business side of the business. And so he and I would do pitches together. And lots of client service people don't like doing presentations or pitches. They don't like it. They prefer to sort of concentrate on existing clients. I actually really enjoy presenting. I think it's one of the really challenging things about the role is to deliver an amazing presentation to a group of people you may not have ever met before.
That's the most fun part to me. Like that's the part I loved about selling.
Absolutely brilliant. That part. And Gareth and I had at one point 100% record in pitches. So I think we did about, and in our industry, you probably reckon to win 1 in 3. It's probably pretty good going. we won, I think, 8 on the run. And we had this amazing, I think amazing chemistry. We worked well together, and I think we presented well together. And then what happened was Gareth, this guy, moved to another firm, and the company I was with offered me his role effectively. And I thought, okay, I'm a bit fed up of sort of day-to-day client service. I like the buzz of new business. I like the buzz of winning stuff, and I like the buzz of presenting, and also not just presenting myself, but also galvanizing a team to deliver a great presentation. Because a lot of the art of it is getting people from across the agency to contribute to something which isn't their day job. And that can be really challenging, but it's something I really like doing. You're like sort of a ringmaster of a circus. And I think that's a really nice way to progress. And I think that's why I sort of ended up in that sort of business development role.
Well, and that also goes back to cricket. I mean, your team sports growing up, you can see how you play a team sport, you've got to get everyone on the same page, you know, even on the fringes, to be moving in the same direction.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, team sport is one of my, you know, I still play football. I don't play cricket anymore because there's not a lot of it going on here. But that's, you know, as you and I have discussed, I've moved into a rather more solitary sport, golf, which from time to time, I wish there were other people there to take my shots for me. So it's a bit of a shit. But that team thing, I think you're right, is very, very important in my view.
So what I want to do is I want to move to what's called my Fast Five. And these are five random questions. And then we're going to talk more about just the industry that you're in and how you've seen it change and what you're kind of seeing in the Middle East, you know, in terms of what you do. So
yeah.
Are you ready to play Fast Freaking Five?
Bring it on.
All right. Question one. What was your first job ever?
My first job ever was in a pub in the UK. And I was too young to serve behind the bar, but this particular pub had waiters. So you could give your drinks order to me as your waiter. I would go to the bar, get your drinks, take them back to you, and I would get the money off you and then give you your change.
How old were you then?
I was 16, 17. And at the end of every night, I would have pockets full of change as tips. It was great.
Did you learn anything from that?
I learned that some people give tips and some people don't.
So an underlying lesson might be generosity.
Yeah, and funny enough, there are very, very few pubs in the UK that actually do that. So it was a bit of a unique. I had to wear a horrible white steward's coat, and it's good fun. Good fun, I think.
All right. Question two: what advice would you give your 25-year-old self?
Put some money in a pension now, and carry on putting money in that pension as much as you can. I know it sounds really hackneyed and corny, but, you know, I know when you're 25, retirement seems a hell of a long way away, but to be honest, you need a hell of a lot of money to survive retirement. So if you can, do it.
I remember when I was 18, I sat down with this financial planner, and he's like, if you just give me $25 a month, you know, it'll be worth X dollars in 10 years. And I was like, man, that's like five less beers. Are you kidding me?
Yes.
my whole concept of what that meant at 18 was so stupid and naive. Yeah, it's ridiculous. All right. But you wouldn't give yourself any other advice, like, I don't know.
Don't get divorced. I would give my advice, that advice. Or perhaps not get married at that point, possibly.
maybe yes, the latter, not the former.
Yes.
All right. Question number three. Sorry, I'm laughing because I can't wait to hear the answer on this one. What animal best describes your management style?
So I thought I did think a little bit about this one. I thought that in my role, you have to be very chameleon-like. You have to sort of adapt and change to your surroundings and the situations that you're in and the people that you're dealing with. And I learned that very early on, that particularly when you manage people, that not everybody responds in the way that you do to stimuli or instructions or requests. And I think it takes a bit of getting used to that. I think you getting yourself into the mindset of other people and understand what motivates them is a really good skill to develop as any sort of manager. And I think when you're young and you're thrust into a management role, as I was, it takes a while for that to sink in. And you think, why the hell didn't that person do what I asked them to do? And then you think back and you think, well, it's probably the way I asked them or the way in which I followed it up or something. And I think that sort of ability to be quite adaptable is probably the key to it from my point of view.
And don't you reckon that a lot of people just, a lot of leaders, and I'm making a generalization here, the difference between highly successful leaders, generally speaking, and less successful leaders is the ability to adapt to the situation you're in to influence the people the way they need to be influenced.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, my first real boss, I guess, was a bit of a hooligan, to be honest with you. I mean, he was a severely violently tempered man. I mean, he would genuinely lose his temper with people in the office, and he would shout, and he would bawl, and it's behavior that wouldn't be tolerated in the workplace these days. But he, that was his way, you know. It was either his way or the highway. And you know, I learned
like
a lot.
Donald Trump.
Oh, crikey. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. And I learned so much from John about what not to do with people. And for that, I'll always be grateful.
I like the backhanded compliment. It's awesome. All right. Question 4. So this is a new style of question. It's a would you rather question.
Yeah.
So in thinking about kind of your background and who you are, I thought it would be appropriate to ask a sports would you rather. So if you had the ability to do so, would you rather play cricket every day for the rest of your life or golf every day for the rest of your life?
Wow. That's a really good question. that's a really good question. James, I think that's a really, really shitty question as well, because I want to do both. I really want to do both.
But that's why it's a would you rather.
I know. I think I would rather play cricket every day because it's, we've talked about the team thing already. Yeah. I think it's about camaraderie. It's about people being reliant on each other to achieve a common goal. And I know that sounds a bit corny, but it's what happens. And cricket in particular is quite a cerebral game. So I know lots of people, you know, I really like baseball as well as a game because it's stats and it's numbers. There's a bit of strategy around it. And I think that cricket stretches you from a personality point of view in a team environment. Golf does that. I mean, it's the most frustrating game in the world if you're a bit average at it like I am. Cricket, I think, stretches you in different ways. It's a mental challenge in the same way that golf is, but you have to think on behalf of you, but also your team. Particularly, you know, I've captained cricket teams, and that is tough. Captaining and doing the strategy, and again, it's that keeping people happy and understanding where they are and how they're feeling and what their motivation is and what you need to say to them to make them perform and what you say to them if they don't perform. So I would, on the balance, I would go for cricket, I think.
All right, question 5. When you die, because that does happen at some point, talk about starting off morbid. What do you want people to say? Like, what do you want people to say about you at your funeral?
I want them to say that he always bought his round in the bar, and that it's funny. It's one of the things. My dad has given me very few words of advice, but the two that stick with me most are always have a firm handshake and always get your round in a pub. And I think those two pieces of advice have always been very, very valuable. And I'm hoping that people at my funeral will have a good time and will remember me as a friend, as an ally, as somebody they were happy to be with. I don't have any grand designs about any sort of legacy. I just want people to have enjoyed my company. I think that would be my primary desire.
I could see the conversation going like, that Paul, he had a really firm handshake and he bought us all around the beer. He's a stand-up bloke, I tell you.
Absolutely. And at my funeral, there will be beer to all to everybody who attends. It will be in my will as soon as I write one.
Well, thanks for doing Fast Five. Today's Fast Five is brought to you by C-Suite TV. C-Suite TV is the place you go to get on demand when you want it, where you want it, and on any device that you want it, content from executives from around the world. That is C-Suite TV at www.c-suitetv.com. Now, back to the interview. And what I want to do for the next 5-10 minutes is to just to quickly talk about just the industry you're in. So just to reiterate again what you said earlier, what exactly does your industry do, which is kind of a unique space in advertising?
Yeah, so this is advertising and marketing, which is very much around recruitment. So we're not a recruitment consultancy. We don't handle people's CVs. We don't sort of punt out candidates to organizations. We tend to work with organizations who need assistance in recruiting new people into their organization. And that assistance could involve things like designing and building careers websites. It could be looking at employer brand and employee value propositions for organizations. It could be in these days about how they get themselves out there using social media platforms. So, for example, does their corporate LinkedIn site look good? Is their corporate Facebook site engaging? And it's all about those communications with employees. We also do a huge amount in terms of internal comms. So how are a company's culture, mission and values communicated internally? Are people bought into those mission and values? Do they then go become a sort of ambassador for that particular brand? And that's where we've come from. And, you know, it's that industry, and we've talked about how industries change. And, you know, although I've been over 30 years in this particular business, it's changed out of all recognition from where it used to be.
Well, and I remember, you know, just we talked about this, that, you know, when I started, this is still the time where you would call the paper, you would ask about the size, how much it was per column inch. And you would create it and you would send it over. And I can't remember the name of the file, but you would send it over in a file to them and they would upload it and put it in the paper for print. I mean, and I was right at the time as the monster.coms and the hot jobs were coming out, and they were kind of frowned upon by major employers because they're like, what's the point?
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, I think in the last year, Monster actually bought the company that I worked for at the time. And that year, we placed 96,000 press advertisements just in 1 year. And a lot of it was, as you say, it was single column centimeter stuff, sort of ads which had a picture or an illustration that were very rare still. We used to send physical hard artwork to newspapers at that time. We used to use the fax to send across copy, and the newspapers would set it. So the whole landscape changed with the job boards. And as you say, many employers were very wary of job boards, and certainly the traditional media didn't take them seriously at all. In fact, a very good friend of mine who worked for one of the local newspapers, he did an MBA at the time or a dissertation on the impact of the internet. And he worked for a large newspaper group, and he went to present his dissertation to the board. And at the end of this presentation, where he said, basically, print media is going to die. You're going to have to get on board with this online stuff. The chairman said to him, well, that's a really strange way to hand a new notice, Mark. And they just didn't believe that what was going to happen would happen. And Monster came over. They thought, okay, 96,000 ads at £10 a time, I can make a lot of money here. And that's how they grew their business. And what happened subsequent to that is obviously most of the agencies were reliant on media commission to actually fund themselves. And as the media commissions got eroded, clients wanted a slice of it, internet, online, job board advertising took over, which was smaller margins. That whole source of revenue for the agencies disappeared overnight virtually. And so the more agile agencies had to move into different spaces. And that's why most of the agencies in this space are much more about projects like employer branding and employee engagement.
Well, didn't it become more like a consultancy now? Like it's more of a way to consult with you and here's some of our products to help you achieve your goals.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that sort of manifested itself in agencies having people filling in timesheets each week. So you could see what accounts they were working on for how long, and almost in the same way that lawyers, accountants have billable time, that sort of ethos came into our business. And
did that ruin it? How did it change it from almost like order taking? It's kind of what it was initially. It was a transactional business.
Yes.
Like consultative business. How did that change the people in the business? How did that change the interaction with the clients?
Well, a lot of the people who were doing the transactional stuff left the industry. I mean, there was basically no room for them anymore. And a lot of the people who I'd grown up with within the business left, and you know, they never really re-emerged. I think the people who stayed with it, you know, like myself, we had to adapt. We had to sort of understand the way in which things were going and sort of move with it. And I've always been quite an early adopter in terms of technology and new techniques and new ideas. And I think that's helped to sort of stay in the industry for as long as I had. And, you know, that's not to say I haven't tried to get out from time to time. I mean, I was made redundant a few times. I was out of work for a couple of years in London and, you know, wanted really to try and change direction completely. But in the end, it sort of drags you back in because it's what you know, and it's people that you know, and it's clients that you know. And in some ways, it gets to a point where it's almost impossible to leave, a bit like Hotel California. And you just can't get away. But what you have to do is change and adapt. And I think those people who have been successful have managed to do that.
I was just going to say, you know, so through this adaptation, you know, you have the internet becomes more complex. You have bidding for placement. You have social media, you have mobile phones. I mean, all of this impacts the employee engagement process. How does a company like Havas tackle that? And specifically, how do they tackle that for the Middle East and North Africa?
So I think here in the Middle East, North Africa, the region is a bit behind the UK and the US and Europe in terms of the take up of social media or the recognition of social media as a trustworthy tool with which to contact and engage with potential candidates. I think that part of my role here is to educate people around that. I think it's people can't ignore social media. If you look at the stats for the Middle East, you know, it's through the roof. If you look at particularly stats for Saudi, for example, in terms of mobile use and social media use, I mean, particularly that millennial generation is never offline at all. And I think that the way in which organizations portray themselves on those channels is becoming increasingly important. And a lot of the work that we're doing here is to advise organizations on how to do that without coming across as too corporate, and to inject a bit of personality and culture into that messaging in order for candidates to make up their minds about whether an organization is going to be right for them from a cultural point of view. And that's what it's all about. And particularly when you move into programmatic advertising, which is a huge area of growth for us, we are targeting candidates by their age, their culture, their social media habits, to really get organizations' messages direct to those people who might be interested in them. And that's a massive change. So whereas when we first started, you put an ad in the paper, you had no idea who was reading it. Because of the analytics you have available now, you can tell exactly who's read it and when they've read it and what action they took after they've read it.
And you can be so much more responsive.
Absolutely. So you can move budget around. So you see a piece of creative that's working particularly well, and a little bit that's not working so well, you pour more money or more resource into the creative that's working better. And because you can report in real time on this activity, you can see spikes in activity, you can see spikes in terms of visits to your careers website. And once you track traffic through the website, you can see whether people are applying or whether they're leaving the site. And you can start to analyze why people aren't engaging with you as an organization.
So with that, what are some challenges you've seen here? You know, because the term employee engagement is massive. And a part of your job is not only attracting employees, but it's getting employees to be more engaged through communications in the workplace. And yes. So what are you seeing as some of the challenges? And let me preference this by saying that, you know, there's a huge movement afoot. It will be a little bit later here, but about increasing employee engagement by using corporate wellness, corporate health and well-being to get employees to engage in healthy behavior as a way to actually manifest a stronger corporate culture. So what are you seeing here in the Middle East in terms of trying to move things in that direction?
I think the main issue here is it's by its very nature quite a conservative culture. And I think the preponderance of public sector and semi-public sector organizations as well, you know, you look at the DWAs of this world or the RTAs or Dubai Airports or whoever it might be, there is an innate conservatism within those businesses. And I think there's an education piece to be had around it's almost a truism that engaged employees are more productive. But I think that here there's almost an education piece around that to actually prove that more engaged employees are more productive employees. And actually, I think to a large extent, we have to try and tie in corporate well-being, employee engagement, whatever you need to call it, to sort of bottom line performance of those organizations. Because ultimately, that's what those companies are in business to do, is to make profits, unless obviously you're in the charitable sector. But I think in terms of that top table discussion, we need to be able to show a correlation between these types of initiatives and performance of those employees in their roles. And I think it's quite hard to measure, and it's certainly not short-term measurable. But I think it's where we need to be getting to. And I think what you can do is you can start to track employees when they join an organization and find out where they are in 3 months' time, in 6 months' time, a year, 18 months, 2 years, whether they're still there, whether they've progressed, what their journey has been. And certainly some of the work we've been doing around careers websites and social media platforms, for example, is doing sort of video work with employees to sort of tell their own story, because potential employees want to see and hear authentic stories about what has happened to a particular person. And so they relate to those.
So when you tell us authentic stories, sorry, one of the things that, you know, I'm a skeptic at heart when I see those things. So, sure. But I believe, that's my podcast is predicated on authenticity. So like, yeah. I buy it, I get it. But do you ever share negative stories that turn to positive, like something that wasn't going well? Because then it seems more real to me, right? So if I said I joined the organization and I was confused and a little bit lost and I was unhappy, but this happened and this is the result, I've been here ever since.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, prime example, we did some work with L'Oreal recently, and we produced about 8 or 9 relatively short videos, sort of 30 to 60 seconds. And one of the people that we profiled there said, I joined L'Oreal, I thought I was going to do this. In fact, I ended up doing this, and now I'm doing this. And they could sort of show a career progression and a story behind it and why they'd ended up where they'd ended up. And I think those stories are really important. And we did some recently for another organization. We did 12 videos, and some of the people were quite nervous in front of camera, because you never quite know how people are going to react in front of a camera. And part of the skill is trying to draw their story out. And obviously the skillful editing will also help that as well. But once you see, I think people want to see that nervousness. They don't want to see polished performers. They want to see real people and telling what really happened to them. And they then can make their own conclusions about whether that organization is one where they could fit in, whether they can see themselves working in that environment, whether some of what these video profilers are saying resonates with them from their career point of view. And I think the whole rise of video is the big thing at the moment. I mean, video is everywhere. So videos on websites, video interviewing is growing massively. And obviously with the sort of predominance of smartphones, Skype technology, et cetera, that sort of real life face-to-face interaction is massive. And I think organizations, need, sorry, I'm wombling on a bit here, I'm sorry about that, but organizations need to have that face-to-face communication with their employees. I think if you hide behind corporateness, then that's not good.
Well, you know, it's my opinion that when we talk about corporate culture and the onboarding process, you know, so let me back up. So one of the things that I'm really interested in from a personal perspective is the idea of creating nudges in the workplace that enhance the worker's experience. And it's my opinion, I have no data to back this up, so just a gut instinct and intuition, that if you can create these nudges in a way that enhances people's daily lives there, because they are spending 8 to 10 hours a day at office, they are going to be more loyal. They're going to spend more time, be more present. They're going to recommend better people, which in turn, and you said it earlier, it's tough to quantify corporate culture. There's some research out there that talks about stocks and companies that have a culture of health and wellness and a strong corporate culture, that their stock prices outperformed other organizations that did not have the same culture.
Yes.
And so there's a growing body of literature that just says that if you can engage your people from the onboarding process to the process of being part of a team, all of that makes a difference. What's hard in this particular culture is you have a disparate culture of basically world travelers coming and going. And the challenge that you have from a hiring perspective is to figure out how you can vet the right employee who is here for the right reasons, coupled for their personal reasons, if that makes sense. And that's a difficult balance, right? This is a very cutthroat, I can switch employees pretty quick, there's a shortage of talent, all sorts of those things are issues. And I feel like, you know, your biggest challenge while you're here is going to be able to work with companies on trying, if this is their goal and their mission, on trying to acquire and keep employees for as long as humanly possible to lower their actual cost on turnover. That would be my guess.
Yeah, I think that's right to a certain extent. I think organizations that keep employees for too long suffer. So if your attrition rate is too low, I think that also has a negative effect, because you tend to have people. You tend to have people if they've been there 30, 40 years. And the organization wants to change or go in a different direction, probably those people aren't going to be the right people to take you there. And if they're too comfortable and it's hard to displace them, then I think that is also can have a negative effect in terms of culture and values.
But I'm not talking 30 years in this environment. I'm talking past 4 years. Hmm. You know, like that's hard to find someone who's there between 2 and 4 years. Now, certainly 20, 30 years, not that you want to shove somebody out the door at 30 years, Paul.
What are you trying to say, James?
I'm not saying anything. I'm just throwing a name out there.
Okay.
But you know, if you can get people to stay here for 10 years, you know, you're still getting fresh people in all the time, but it's going to lower their cost in the long term if you can keep your employees for at least, you know, 10 years, 5 years of 10 years. That's all I'm trying to say. I'm not trying to say the 30-year mark. Sure, there's pros and cons to both of those for people there that long.
I think even 5 to 10 years is probably too long, particularly for the younger people. They, I think, will move around much more frequently than that. I think sort of 2 to 3 years is probably the most you're going to expect out of the millennial generation from the research that we've done and sort of anecdotal evidence that we have. But you're right. I think the main issue is, have you got the right people? It's not their longevity. It's whether they're right, mm-hmm. whether they're the right cultural fit, and also whether they have the right skills and expertise to take that organization where it needs to go to. And I think that's when you start to recruit against an organization's business goals, that's when you start to really sort of hit the mother load, because you're recruiting against a set of culture and values which is aimed at delivering a particular set of figures or targets or objectives or whatever it might be. And I think that correlation is really important, and organizations need to gear their interviewing, their selection, their assessment, their onboarding process to making sure that the right people for that organization, not just now but in the future, are the ones that they actually recruit in the end.
Well, this could be a fascinating conversation to go on for hours and hours. However, we've been on for an hour. So I have one final question for you, and this is one that I ask everybody as well. I want to know how you personally, how you define happiness.
So, happiness. For me, it's about that feeling of contentedness across most aspects of your lives. And I think most people at one point or another aren't happy with one bit of their life, whether it's personal or professional or whatever it might be. But I think happiness is about gaining that sort of balance where you're happy personally and you're also happy professionally. And in my experience, it's not a sort of a state that you find yourself in massively often, or it hasn't been for me massively often, I guess. I mean, for example, now I would say I was happy. 5 years ago, I would have said, no, I'm not. And 10 years ago, I would have said, certainly I'm not. So I think it's about that balance. And it's, you know, that work-life thing is really important. So it's about family, but it's also about your family at work. And I think that's where I would define happiness for me.
Awesome. Well, Paul Turner, thank you very much for your time and your energy, for stopping by.
It's been a pleasure.
Executive, I wasn't finished with my closing. Come on, give me a second here.
Sorry, is it like talking over the intro of a record? Is that what it's like?
Yeah. Your time and energy for stopping by. Thanks. Executive After Hours. Thanks, Paul. Have a great day.
Cheers, James. All the best, mate.